It took the Election Commission of Pakistan 7 years to conclude the illegal funding case against the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The case that was filed by one of the founding members of Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party maintained that his party received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities. In a 70-page judgment, the Election Commission confirmed that Tehreek-e-Insaf was guilty and concealed 16 bank accounts through which it accepted donations from foreigners or foreign groups.
I thank God that our 8-year struggle has paid off. I have no personal interest in this case. This is in the national interest that Pakistani political parties and their leadership must be subservient to the law.
The Election Commission also ruled that the former Prime Minister submitted false statements regarding his party's funding, but the party of Imran Khan has dismissed the charges.
We have been saying all along that this is not a case of foreign funding, but prohibited funding. Today's ruling has vindicated our stance that our political party has received no foreign funding.
The ruling comes over 3 months after Khan lost his office in a vote of no confidence in April. But Khan still insists he was ousted from power through a US-backed conspiracy.
Was there any crisis in the country when the US toppled our government? And those responsible in Pakistan to stop this conspiracy have acted as mere spectators.
Despite being ousted from power, Khan's popularity has increased. This was reflected in by-elections held recently in Punjab, where Khan's party swept the polls. The unexpected victory by Khan's party has allowed them to regain control of Punjab province.
There is no immediate fallout of the Election Commission's ruling on Khan and his party. Nevertheless, findings of the Election Commission may lead to legal challenges for the former Prime Minister. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Over the past few decades, China and the United States have been on the collision course on various issues, ranging from trade, human rights, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, to the COVID-19 outbreak. The already tense relation has soured further with a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, a self-ruled island Beijing considers as part of its territory. Pelosi made a one-day trip to Taiwan during her ongoing East Asia tour despite repeated warnings from Beijing that such a move could embolden pro-independence forces there. She used an Air Force plane to get to Taiwan, while over a dozen American fighter jets kept an eye on her. Upon arrival, Pelosi defended the controversial visit.
Our delegation's visit to Taiwan honors America's unwavering commitment to supporting Taiwan's vibrant democracy.
During her trip, Pelosi met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. She was also awarded the highest civilian award as a, quote, symbol of America's strong and enduring friendship with the island. In response to the visit, Beijing has announced military drills, including a series of live fire maneuvers around Taiwan, including in the strategic Taiwan Strait. Taipei has reacted angrily, saying the drills and encircling of the island by Chinese forces are similar to an invasion. Beijing has also put curbs on some imports from Taiwan, while halting sand shipments to the island.
This is a complete farce. The United States is violating China's sovereignty under the guise of so-called democracy. Those who offend China will be punished. Those who play with fire will not come to a good end.
Pelosi has already concluded her trip to Taiwan, but it seems to have negative and far-reaching consequences for the island and the U.S., as Beijing has described Washington's action as extremely dangerous. Taiwan is not the only irritant issue in ties between Beijing and Washington. The U.S. is missing no chance to pit regional countries against China, whether there is a maritime dispute or other bilateral issues. The reality is that there are several economic, political, and strategic issues involved in U.S. policies in Asia-Pacific. One can also not ignore the constant U.S. meddling under the pretext of security amid rising China's influence. It's too early to say that China and the U.S. may engage in an open conflict. But with ever-increasing frictions and the continued U.S. meddling, it seems that the strained ties between the two are very unlikely to ease anytime soon.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the seventh edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shirin was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shirin Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and the rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Two days after several explosions rocked the northern neighborhood of Wazir Akbar Khan in the Afghan capital Kabul, the U.S. claims the CIA successfully targeted a safe house there, killing al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. The pressure is again on people, as unfortunately, it has become very common to wake up to the sound of explosions every morning.
It was 6 o'clock in the morning when a strong explosion shocked us. We were working here and saw the smoke. I don't know the cause of the blast, but Taliban did not let anyone get close to the area.
At first, the Taliban claimed that the explosions were caused by blind rockets. Now that the drone strike has been confirmed, the Taliban condemn it and consider it a violation of Afghan sovereignty and the Doha Agreement signed between them and the U.S. They also stressed that the targeted house was empty during the raid and that there were no casualties.
As it is about sovereignty of Afghanistan, no country has the right to attack Afghanistan with manned or unmanned planes. The statements that the U.S. is making on al-Zawahiri are just claims. The U.S. does what it wants by force.
The recent airstrike in Kabul has now stoked fears among people. They are scared that such incidents might happen more and more frequently as they witnessed 10 members of a family, including 6 children, were targeted a year ago in a drone strike before the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The Afghan people are most shocked by what happened. They say their land has become a hotspot for settling international accounts they have nothing to do with. But as always, they have to bear the brunt of such incidents. Abdullah Amirzadeh from Kabul.
Lebanon's leaders have once more met with the U.S. Energy Envoy, who is in Beirut for talks. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati, and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri have reportedly given the envoy a unified Lebanese proposal, which the envoy will be taking to the Israeli side for a response. Amos Hochstein told reporters after the meeting that he was optimistic that a demarcation agreement will be reached in the coming weeks.
I remain optimistic that we can make continuous progress as we have over the last several weeks, and I look forward to coming back to the region and being able to make the final arrangement.
This comes one day after Hezbollah's resistance movement released footage of gas barges in the Quraysh field, their coordinates and a surface-to-sea missile, warning the Israelis that wasting time is not beneficial.
The video released by the resistance will strengthen Lebanon's position as a party in the talks and will give the three leaders a new bargaining chip, just like the Hezbollah drones help move the talks forward and bring Hochstein back to Lebanon. The coming hours will be decisive, and we will see realistic steps and will most probably go back to indirect talks in Nahura, but we have very little time.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also repeated that all Hezbollah wants in this file is to help Lebanon and give the state elements of strength in the negotiations.
If we cannot drill and take out our wealth, so nobody else will do. And we are waiting until we see if Hochstein has in his trip to Lebanon any solution to lift off all the sanctions against Lebanon.
Said Nasrallah said in light of the outcome, Hezbollah will decide how to act in the coming period. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun has stressed that he will not be lenient when it comes to Lebanon's right to its natural resources. He also said he will no longer accept that Lebanon be the subject of discrimination as it has in the past. The statement is backed by what seems to be a new strategy by the resistance, which could give Lebanon the upper hand in the maritime talks. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013, only 2 years after U.S. Special Forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman A police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana, scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Purza, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم السلام علیک یا سار الله
Creation is in shock as you prepare to die. Everything you gave without complaint. You died a tragic death, but you did not die in vain. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has issued a warning about Israel's nuclear arsenal, in particular its nuclear warheads, which is estimated to number between 200 to 400. This is while Israel has not only been claiming that Iran is just a short time away from obtaining the bomb, it has also threatened Iran with military action. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how it is that Israel and not Iran, who is a threat not only to the Islamic Republic, but also to the West Asia region as a whole. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille, France. Also joining us, former U.S. government advisor Paul LaRudy, who joins us from Berkeley. Welcome to you both. Paul LaRudy, I'm going to first start with you. I'm curious as to why Israel is pursuing a policy of what they call deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, when it is very well known that it does possess between 200 to 400 of them, warheads in particular. Not only the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that, but you also have that whistleblower Vanunu who has claimed that. But why does it pursue this policy of what it calls nuclear ambiguity?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is that the U.S. Congress has passed, the U.S. government has passed legislation saying that the U.S. cannot provide aid of any kind to any country that possesses nuclear weapons and develops nuclear weapons. Therefore, since this is an agreement between Israel and the United States, and the State Department of the United States every year certifies that they have no evidence that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, in which case it is permissible to provide Israel with aid. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. There are other reasons that Israel considers it advantageous, but this is the main one that began decades ago.
Like, what are the reasons that it does not want to claim that you said are advantageous for not stating it?
Well, they can't be held in non-compliance with various international treaties if they don't belong to those treaties, and if they supposedly don't have nuclear weapons, and they can't be held accountable. I think on a variety of metrics, means of judging them. They can't be held accountable if it's not certain that they have these weapons.
Okay, Elijah Magner, we have what Iran has stated, and many are also questioning as to why you have the NPT, and when you have the threat that are posed by nuclear weapons, that Israel, which again, even though they don't want to admit it, but have 200 to 400 of these nuclear warheads, are not a member of the NPT. Iran says it should be a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And the big question is, why isn't the IAEA actually fulfilling its responsibility in this regard to pursue this matter with Israel? Of course, Iran is saying that because it's also being threatened by Israel militarily, but above and beyond that, Israel keeps accusing Iran of pursuing a path towards weaponizing its nuclear program.
Thank you for having me. The answer is quite simple. The IAEA was formed in 1957 by the Americans. And since the 1957, the Israelis were engaged at the beginning with building a nuclear reactor with the help of France, Norway, and the Americans. And since then, the IAEA never inspected the Israeli nuclear plant. It was only later when Ben-Gurion admitted that the Dimona was hosting what used to be a textile factory, in fact, was a nuclear reactor. And the reason why the Israelis said for the first time, we're talking about in 1962, 1963, when they admitted the first time that they may have developed a nuclear weapons in their what used to be called textile factory, only deterrent to Arab actions against Israel. So since then, the Americans have created the Atom for Peace program at the time of President Eisenhower and camouflaged the Israeli reactor and the Israeli development of nuclear weapons. It was since then that the Americans planned to hide what the Israelis are doing to prevent the IAEA that was formed by the Americans to go and inspect what the Israelis have and to make sure that the public and the world is aware of the Israeli nuclear capability. Instead, they've hidden all that. The French has hidden all that. Norway hidden all that. And they all aware, the international community is aware, because they have, Norway provided 20 tons of water for the reactor, and France provided the reactor. So they all know what's happening in Israel. They all know about the weapon that Israel have. And also, we know that the Israelis were about to use nuclear weapon during the 6 days war with the Arabs. So now, failing to expose all that and to open the site to international community and international supervision, it shows us first that international supervision is not international, but is under the thumb of the Americans. Second, that everything the Israelis are doing is covered and supported by the Americans. Third, it's a cherry picking for the Americans to go and accuse Iran and Korea and China and the countries that are not friendly to the U.S. and push the IAEA to go and inspect what they are doing with the nuclear reactor, if it is for peace or for weapon purposes.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a nuclear reactor is the fact that it poses a threat or a danger to the environment, Paula Rudy, and given the fact that it's not under the IAEA supervision, as we understand, that this in particular obviously provides a threat to the West Bank. You have nuclear waste that it is alleged that Israel is burying in the West Bank. Shouldn't that be a matter of concern?
Of course it's a matter of concern, especially to the Palestinians themselves. But this is, again, nothing new. Israel has used the occupied territories as a dumping ground for all sorts of toxic waste and materials. And so they consider this a way of continuing the genocide of the Palestinians, destroying the Palestinian people, at least those that are, well, in general, the Palestinian people, both those who are under their direct rule and those that are not, even outside. They've done similar things in Lebanon, for example, and Syria and so forth. They consider it an advantage to be able to put toxic materials where they want to make life miserable, difficult, and even to end life for the people that they want to get rid of. So this is just part of their policy of genocide.
You had an idea that came up during the former president, Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Elijah Magnier, and that was a West Asia or Middle East free zone, as he called it during that time. And just recently, again, Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN has drawn attention to this establishment of a zone free of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, of which it was actually initiated by Iran at the UN. Israel is against that. It does not want that. Coming from Iran and the fact that Israel does not want that, what message is that sending?
Iran is sending a message that the Middle East, as the rest of the world, should be free of weapons of mass destruction. However, this is not what the Americans want. So if we look at all the American administrations, starting from Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, they all hide and hid all the Israeli capability for one purpose, is to keep a deterrence in the Middle East against the U.S. allies, against the U.S. enemies. So when Iran is coming out with a proposal saying we want the Middle East without weapons of mass destruction, is really targeting only Israel because it's the only place where there are weapons of mass destruction. And this goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that want Israel to remain as the policeman of the region, which is not something that Iran accepts, and also all the country where there is a population that stands against the normalization with Israel and refuse what the Israeli did by occupying the Palestinian territory. So by Iran saying, I want a Middle East or an area or half of the world or whatever, free of weapons of mass destruction, it goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that the U.S. will certainly refuse to abide by and will completely ignore the call for a weapons of mass destruction, which is obviously that is directed only toward Israel, and the Americans are not ready to compromise anything what they call the security of the Israelis.
Paula Rudy, I think you also had a response to that.
Mr. Manier is exactly correct. And the United States does not want to give up an advantage or the advantage of its ally, or Israel is just basically an extension of the United States, or you could say the United States is an extension of Israel, if you like. But they have an advantage, which are the nuclear weapons, and they can always threaten others with them and cause problems, as we've already discussed. So this is they want to keep that advantage, and the idea of a nuclear-free or a nuclear weapons-free Middle East is they're not willing to consider it, and they don't have to, because they're the power in the region.
But when you take a look at Israel, Elijah Magnier, Israel is the only entity right now that is not only attacking a sovereign nation repeatedly, namely Syria. It has actually attacked Syria's nuclear facilities at one point in order to, based on its views, to stop the further investment of its nuclear program. At the same time, it is threatening Iran militarily. So when you have an entity that is reacting that way and carries out operations like that, military operations, isn't then Israel at the highest risk of proliferation or using nuclear weapons?
Indeed, it is. Israel did not attack Syria's site only. It has attacked also Iraq in the 80s to stop Iraq from developing its nuclear capability. So any country that stands as strong in competition with Israel, Israel reacts to it with the full support of the United States of America. Now, Israel represents a danger because the Israelis are really looking to attack any country that, for them, can create a threat to Israel. Now, the only threat in the region is Israel itself. To violate the Lebanese air space, to violate Syrian airspace, to bomb Lebanon, to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq. They bombed many sites of the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi security forces, attacks in Iran and assassination. So it's Israel that is taking always initiative and is the first aggressor. Now, as long as it has what Israel called a deterrence, a nuclear deterrence, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a point of strength for Israel, because we've seen how Russia in Ukraine was not able to use its nuclear weapons. However, that doesn't justify that Israel needs to go unchecked and for the world to keep looking the other way about what the Israelis are doing and what are their nuclearity is in the Negev and the Dimona and what they are doing there and how they are developing and if that represents a danger to the civilian population.
Well, you have obviously one of the most important standoffs that can occur because of the way that Israel acts, and that is when it comes to Iran. We have seen what Israel has done in terms of acts of sabotage against Iran, from the assassinations of a number of nuclear scientists to facilities itself, which the most recent one was in Karaj. And one of the most recent developments also was how an Israeli spy cell was actually caught. And one of the revelations was that they wanted to lay bombs at a sensitive site in Esfahan, which, according to one report, they had already gone through and done that. So aren't these all signs that there needs to be some restriction, some oversight, then, back to the question, through the relevant organization, which at this point is the IAEA, in order to stop anything from happening?
Well, neither the IAEA nor the United Nations nor any other organization is going to stop Israel from doing whatever it feels like doing, as long as it feels that it has the power to do it without consequences to itself. And that's unfortunately the situation, and it's the situation of its sponsor, the United States as well. Both entities will do whatever they can to make others subservient to them and to enhance their control of various parts of the world, the population, the economy, the territory. We can talk about what the law says and what morality says and all of these things. But in the end, it is strength that talks. It is power that talks. And Israel is going to use whatever power it has in order to cause disaster for its neighbors, to keep its neighbors in check, and also to use its power to enhance, to enlarge its territory and increase its own power over its neighbors. And that's the same applies to the United States, which, as I said before, is just one is the extension of the other.
Well, Elijah Magner, Israel has sounded the alarm over Iran on so many occasions when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. A quick question that comes about during these times, where we're looking at the revival of the JCPOA, if there's even a point of saying the revival if it's not dead yet, is why doesn't the U.S. just make the political decision to get back into the deal that the U.S. pulled out from in the first place in order to, in their eyes, eliminate any chances that there may be, in their eyes again, for Iran to pursue any type of weaponization of their program, which will then, by default, leave only Israel with nuclear weapons in West Asia?
Because when you give the Americans a finger, they won't. The problem is Iran is negotiating the Americans in good faith, but the Americans and the Europeans are in 2018. One is the American, Donald Trump, just threw away the JCPOA, and the Europeans find themselves withdrawing from Iran and not abiding by their signature. So you are dealing with Western organizations that just want to impose their will and dominate whoever country that is ready to be dominated. Iran is not on the list of dominated countries for the West. And by showing its rejection of the U.S. supremacy and the U.S. control and hegemony, Iran became the enemy. So whatever Iran is doing and offering, the Americans are trying to have a deal where they keep having the upper hand over the Iranians. And Iran is trying to say that we want a deal where we are both equal, where this is the big mistake Iran is doing, because the Americans are not interested in becoming an equal partner in this deal, because they are not a viable partner. They want the upper hand, and they want to make sure that they can return to the sanctions against Iran, because you are dealing with Western, not international organizations like the IAEA that brings out of the hat all the rabbits they want against Iran whenever they want, because they are pushed by the United States. And then you negotiate the peace, a deal that the JCPOA is saying, I agree to control my nuclear program that is weapon-free, and they say, no, but we want to impose sanctions on your institutions because whenever we want, we can cripple your economy. So you are both talking different languages, and it is like you don't understand each other, because the American side is not ready to sit on the table as an equal partner. The Americans want the upper hand. That is the point.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds to give to you, Paula Rudy. You had a statement coming out from the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, that was interesting, that said Iran can transform itself into a nuclear power and it's too late to stop it by surgical attack. Of course, he goes on to say, again, talk about the timeline here, that it will take Iran 18 to 24 months in order to reach that, what did he call it, treating metal uranium and picking it. Well, he talked technically there. You know, you have the threat, and then, but it takes a couple of years, even though the threat is going to take a couple of weeks. Never understood how they always talk about weeks away, and we can go back to 20 years ago up to now. Anyways, what is interesting about this is the fact that you have Israel, who is very much against this JCPOA revival. Why would Israel really be against this if it feels threatened in any shape or form? By Iran pursuing, again, in its eyes, a nuclear weaponization program?
Well, the answer is that Israel does not feel threatened by it, and it considers that it can take whatever measures it needs in order to remain more powerful, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. It's not really afraid of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, most of all because of the policies of the government. The government of Iran has said repeatedly that it has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is not pursuing any nuclear weapons. So this, well. I think this is not an issue.
Thank you very much for that. Paul Rudy there, former U.S. government advisor. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Both of you, thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right extremist group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, Proud Boy Leaders Charged with Seditious Conspiracy in 6th of January Riot. In the United States, top leaders of the far-right militia group, the Proud Boys, including its national chairman, Enrique Tarrio, have been charged with seditious conspiracy for plotting to storm the U.S. Capitol to obstruct the certification of Joe Biden's election win over Donald Trump on 6th of January 2021. The move by federal prosecutors to charge Enrique Tarrio and four other Proud Boys leaders with seditious conspiracy, in addition to previous charges of obstructing a congressional proceeding, marks a major development in the criminal investigation into the Capitol attack. In their 33-page indictment, unsealed in Washington, D.C. on Monday, the Justice Department said Enrique Tarrio and his co-defendants, Joseph Biggs, Ethan Nordine, and Zachary Rell, and Dominic Pizzola, for months used encrypted messaging apps to stop Joe Biden's certification by force. The new charges against the Proud Boys leadership comes just days before the parallel congressional inquiry into the Capitol attack is scheduled to start televised hearings that are expected to examine, in part, Donald Trump's personal culpability in the events of 6th of January 2021. Seditious conspiracy, which is challenging to prove, requires federal prosecutors to show beyond a reasonable doubt that at least two people agreed to use force to overthrow the government or to interfere with the execution of a United States law. The new indictment is the latest involving seditious conspiracy after the Justice Department filed identical charges earlier this year against top members of the far-right militia group the Oath Keepers, including its founder, Stuart Rhodes, over the Capitol attack. A bipartisan U.S. Senate report linked seven deaths to the Capitol attack, which failed to stop certification of Joe Biden's election win. Donald Trump was impeached for inciting an insurrection, but acquitted when enough Senate Republicans stayed loyal to him. In addition, under seditious conspiracy charges, the Justice Department appeared to indicate that it has learned new information in recent weeks about the Proud Boys' plans ahead of 6th of January 2021 as a result of several significant developments. One of the Proud Boys, who was originally charged with Enrique Tarrio and the other co-defendants for obstructing a congressional proceeding, Charles Donahue, pleaded guilty in April and accepted a plea deal to cooperate with the criminal investigation into the militia group.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, though the indictment also identified unindicted co-conspirators, Person 1 is understood to be Jeremy Bertino, and Person 2 is likely to be Aaron Wallen Walkend. Neither of those men have been charged. A third top Proud Boys leader, John Stewart, also remains uncharged. The US government said in the indictment that on 20th of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio created a chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included Nordine, Biggs, Rell, and other individuals who were not identified. Through the rest of December, the government said Proud Boys leaders used additional MOSD group chats to plan a trip to Washington, D.C. and communicate to group members that they should go to the Capitol not wearing their familiar black and yellow colors, but travel incognito instead. The government said in the indictment that on 30th and 31st of December 2020, Enrique Tarrio communicated with an individual whose identity is known only to a grand jury, who sent him a 9-page document called 1776 Returns, in reference to the year of the American independence from Britain. It laid out a plan to occupy crucial buildings on 6th of January 2021. The document broadly outlined a plan to reconnoiter and storm crucial government buildings in Washington, D.C. on 6th of January, though not the Capitol building itself, the New York Times reported earlier. Enrique Tarrio is said to have received the 1776 Returns document from one of his girlfriends, who compared the plan to storming the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia, that sparked the Russian Revolution in 1917, the New York Times reported. The indictment cited a reference to the moment in the new indictment, drawing upon what appeared to be newly uncovered text messages. After the Capitol attack ended, Bertino messaged Enrique Tarrio, 1776, to which Tarrio responded, "The Winter Palace." 3 days before the Capitol attack, a Proud Boy referred to only as Person 3 posted a voice message in the MOSD leaders group that stated the main operating theatre should be out in front of the House of Representatives, according to the indictment. That's where the vote is taking place with all of the objections, the person number 3 said, according to the indictment. Plan the operations based around the front entrance to the Capitol building. I strongly recommend you use the National Mall and not Pennsylvania Avenue. The new pieces of evidence in the latest indictment were messages that Bertino sent to Enrique Tarrio after the attack. "You know we made this happen," Bertino said, referring to the implications of obstructing Joe Biden's win. Bertino added, "They have to certify today or it's invalid." Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington, D.C., however, on 6th of January 2021, having been ordered to leave the Capitol by a judge after being arrested the day before for burning a Black Lives Matter banner at a church during a pro-Donald Trump rally in December. But the Justice Department has said that even though Enrique Tarrio was not accused of physically taking part in the breach of the Capitol building, he led the advance planning and remained in contact with other members of the Proud Boys militia during the attack. 11 members of the Oath Keepers militia are also charged with seditious conspiracy. Lawyers for Enrique Tarrio and other 4 Proud Boys leaders have said there is no evidence they conspired to storm the Capitol building and that the MOSD group chats and the acquisitions of tactical gear before 6th of January were measures to protect themselves in case of potential altercations.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.